John are the three horsemen. They never get along, they're the three horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the three horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride.
Hi, this is Jeff Patterson, and it is time for the March episode of The Three Horsemen, even though we're looming towards the end of March by the time this probably makes to air. The weather is being very weird. We're getting snow one day, 70 degrees the next. Fun. In like a lion, out like a lamb. I am joined, as always, by my two co-hosts. Say hello to Mr. John Stevens.
I'm waiting for someone to say hello.
Hello, John.
There we go. Thank you. Yes, I am here. Hooray.
I'm telling the audience to say hello to you like an old radio guy, you know?
The old ways are the best ways, I says. So, yes, I am here. I am a writer and I am a bookseller, and like I'm trying to recall, right? And I am most frequently found on Twitter by my handle, Erudite Ogre, and I write stuff hither and thither.
And zither, wow. I have not yet achieved thither. I'm getting there. Hither was easy. That was...
Yep, hither's a cakewalk.
Hi, Fred.
Hi, John. Hi, Jeff.
Fred.
Hi, everyone. It's Fred Kish, recovering from the massive two-part interview with Joel Presby and David Weber. And if you want to hear more, they then did a two-part episode at the Bay Inn podcast. So I guess we set the standard.
Trendsetters, I tell you.
Yep.
If you need 4 hours of David Weber talking,
yeah,
come to the right place.
You're good to go.
Yep. And I am at Fred Kish on Twitter, where I am mostly, and my website is Bernal, B-E-R-N-A-L Alpha. And I am not currently in the midst of a nor'easter, as was predicted earlier today by the weather people. And that I am eternally grateful for.
Good. I'm glad we had... Our rain turned to snow quite unexpectedly yesterday, and it was yay. That's what we needed for the last day of winter.
Yeah.
So,
we get it tomorrow.
Oh, really?
No, the problem is this winter they've constantly said there's a snowstorm coming, and then we get some rain. So, I just don't believe them anymore.
Yeah. I don't believe weathermen. Liars, all of them. A friend of mine who's a lawyer once said that if he was incorrect as often as weathermen, he'd be in jail. So we got a couple of things we want to talk about tonight. I want to talk about the collection Up and Coming Stories of the 2016 Campbell Eligible Authors, which John Donato posted a couple of weeks ago on SF Signal. But before I get to that, I wanted to talk to John, who listed writer as one of his little, business card subtitles at the bottom.
Labels,
yeah.
Terrible caricature. Just a terrible caricature.
One of his many hats. John, you had a story go up in a March Madness competition.
I did.
And you tweeted all about it, and
not all about it, but mostly about it.
Mostly about it. I'd like to hear how that came about, because it was actually quite by surprise that I saw you tweet to it, and I was like, "Oh, this is a pleasant surprise."
Mm-hmm. Sheer luck. There we go. Every year for the past few years, Joe has done this competition, and this year gets a benefit for the CIFWA Emergency Medical Fund. And he likes to choose relatively new writers who are still trying to get attention and get their stuff out there.
And what was the website?
Oh, it's grumptroll.com.
Okay.
So I feel a certain kinship with Joe.
Yes, you fit right in.
So Joe was looking for a couple more people to fill slots. And it's pretty challenging. You get a, basically it's set up in little brackets where you get a prompt for the story, and your the other person in your bracket gets sort of something that's opposite or something that's very different. So, and then you have a short amount of time, like a couple of days, to write it. I think it might just be 48 hours, to write it, basically flash, so you're limited to 1,500 words. And I've been kind of struggling with writing lately, so I thought, you know, it might be a good endeavor to see what I can do. So I accepted and got into the first round, and the bracket I was in was Sky versus Sea. And I actually got the notification a little late, due to, joining a little late. So I had a little less than the full amount of time, but that was fine. So I just sat down and started, you know, writing aloud, basically. Because I had no idea what to do about the sea. I mean, the sky. Because I was the sky. So, I wrote this weird little snippet of conversation start, and then I set it aside for a little while, for about half a day, and I came back to it and just finished it up in about 2 hours, I think. I think all told, I spent about 2.5 hours on it. And I might show something kind of strange as the core of the story, which is basically sort of a philosophical discussion between a young boy and three of his elders. Which, I don't know, maybe that wasn't the best choice, because it just was very much, very dialogue heavy and very, you know, so it's a sort of a philosophical piece. So, I don't know if I took a little too much of a risk, or...
Yeah, I like
that. But that was sort of the name of the game. The name of the game was to push yourself and do something you hadn't done much of, or experiment. So I did that. And it went up. It was up for 4 days, and then there was a period of voting, and I got my ass kicked. But it was fun. It was a good experience, because I haven't had a story out there for a little while, so it was nice to have that out there and feel that I could at least do it. And I like the story too. It's part of a larger, it fits into a larger story world that I've got going. And a couple of the characters I've written about before, actually, in another story, so it was fun, and it was also a challenge for me to try to communicate the ideas that these people have, which aren't immediately recognizable. And that was sort of the challenge I gave myself, and that was the result.
No, I liked it. It was cool. Nice little surprise to see that pop up there.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
So
they're just running it now. They're not going to, like, run another bracket.
So what they'll do now is they'll run basically the semifinals.
Right.
With the remaining four writers. And then it will do a final round with the top two writers.
Mm-hmm. And they have to write new content for each round?
Do, and the same thing, they get the prompt just a couple days before it's due.
Oh, good lord.
And yeah, I mean, it's when I first sat down and thought about it, I thought, you know, the sky? What am I going to write, a bird story? But I didn't want to write a obvious story. So I want to sort of talk about the sky, not just as, you know, the vast expanse above us, but, you know, how do we look at the sky? How might other people look at the sky? What is the sky essentially useful for, culturally? So, that's what I got.
Cool. That's real neat. The writing group I'm in is doing their second anthology coming up, and I gotta turn a story in for that shortly. And the theme of it is relics. And I've had like three or four really neat ideas that are floating around in my head, and every time I go to do them, I go, I keep sort of going off the beam here. So maybe I need to take a page from your playbook and just regurgitate something out and see how it lands, and then go back and shape it.
Well, yeah, when you get to the point where you're overthinking it, it seems to me that's the time you just kind of try something on paper and see how it feels and what it can lead to, and go from there.
No, I hear that.
Jeff, has your writing group published anthologies in the past?
Yes, they had one called Go, and here's where I'm going to have to do an audio edit. Uncommon Threads.
And is this common among writing groups, or is this unique?
I genuinely don't know. The last writing group that I was in was in the 1980s, so... and we certainly didn't, but a lot of the people who are in the writing group that I am in, are self-published writers.
Okay.
And a couple of them have actually had stories in some fairly decent sized markets, but several of the, people that we have in the group have made a fairly lucrative showing being, self-published. So there's one of the people who are there. Uncommon Threads, London Writers Anthology, Volume 1, came out June of 2015. And it is available on Amazon.
All right.
So they're doing their second volume, which is going to be about relics, and as I've been doing my work in progress with them going on 27, 28 weeks now, I said, yeah, I should put something together for it. So, but no, I can definitely, when you have a theme that needs to be fulfilled, it certainly can both bound and liberate one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny this comes up, especially when we're talking about short fiction, because the thing that was really on my radar this week was on March 8th, John DiNardo posted a link to the anthology Up and Coming Stories by the 2016 Campbell Eligible Authors, available as a free download, and it is available as a free download up until the 31st of March, and I began perusing this. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that went through my mind was, my God, what a wonderful resource this is for keeping track of everybody who's a writer, because this thing is clearly, it's the size of, like, The Weird by the Vandermeers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's over a million words long. There are 230 stories in there.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's great.
Yeah. By 120 authors, 230 stories. And they're culled from 2014, 2015, and 2016. And of course, there's this big disclaimer that it has nothing to do with CIFWA, and I got a chuckle out of that, because the one thing I thought that this, even though the story has a number of links to individual authors, and maybe I haven't explored this all the way, I should check before I'm talking out of my ass here, But the one thing I think really, even though every story that I'm seeing in here is denoting where it was from, where it was published, when it was published, and stuff like that, this would be a perfect opportunity to use the wonderful hyperlink functions of EPUBs and link to either those individual issues or the publications that they were called from. That's probably my only criticism. I've read about maybe 10 stories out of this thing so far. And quite frankly, I am viewing this as a, I'm not viewing it as an anthology as much as I'm viewing it as a utility almost. And as such, I'm sort of treating it, I'm finding my approach to it a little different. Like I was very surprised to see a Frank Wu story in here that I had read a while ago, the one he had in Analog. And it was nice just going through the listing and saying, hey, I've read this before, and having that small little victory in my head saying, this is a story I'm aware of, which was surprising that as many of them I had read, given how much I've been coming down on myself for not keeping up with a lot of stuff. But a good chunk of this is because I listened to so much audio podcasts last year. Quite a few of these are from Beyond Ceaseless Skies and Clark's World. And there's quite a bit of small press on here as well, which made me very happy. So, yes, this is a big, giant, massive chunk of short stories to read. Fred, how many shorts are you up to this year so far?
I think 131.
Oh, good Lord.
Mm.
So this is a big chunk. So I commend S.L. Huang and Kurt Hunt for putting this thing together. And I really hope that we see this on a fairly annual basis, provided there is no major dropout or ugly set of legal hurdles that need to be dealt with, because this is this is... Like when I went to World Fantasy in 2014, they handed us all thumb drives with like all these stories that were eligible for a number of different awards. And I know that, with you guys, you always get the packets of things that are nominated. To see an actual package of things that are eligible is almost a bit overwhelming.
Oh, sure.
But I'm really hoping this is going to be a fairly regular thing, even if it's in some form of truncated form. It's just brilliant. It really is.
So did you know that it's been done before?
No, I did not.
Ah, because I was in the first two.
Really?
Back when I was Campbell eligible, yeah. Mark Blake did it for several years, and I guess he's passed the baton.
And when was that? What years were those?
So 2011 is when it started, because that was my first year of eligibility.
Mm-hmm.
But then he did it, there was a 12, a 13, and a 14. I think there was a 15. I might have it. I mean, I've got them all somewhere in my...
This has got 15 in it.
Yeah, this volume here.
Oh, okay, right. So he went up to 14. Okay, right.
Okay. Yeah, this covers, in the preface, it says it covers all the pieces appeared in 2014, 2015, 2016.
Okay.
Well, then you have filled a gap in my knowledge, because I was not aware that such a thing had actually been generated, and this is precisely the kind of thing I sort of keep an eye out for.
Right. And my understanding is that the limited download window is to... There are a lot of copyright issues to deal with.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure there are.
And that's a lot of what the editors have to do. I mean, I know Mark was constantly... That was like the biggest part of their job, was to essentially secure the rights for this temporary thing as a promotional item. So not an item anyone's going to profit off or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, and it's great. I mean, I do enjoy them when they come out. So I've downloaded the new one, and I have not touched it yet.
I hopped around and I did quite a few quite a few pieces of Flash Fiction that were in there. The Kim May stories. There's a lot. There's it's too much.
No, it is. It's, I mean, when you start going through it, it's like, this is huge.
Well, that's
and that one's bigger because I think it combines more stories. The older ones were still quite voluminous, but that one,
But it's one of those, the usefulness of it, in my mind, the reason I'm thinking about it as a utility more than an anthology, is because it was very eye-opening when it came to the number of new names that are appearing in the field. And given the sheer number of markets that are represented as well, and I'm not saying that one cannot consider oneself versed or literate in contemporary SF unless one knows all these things. But one owes it to oneself to at least read a table of contents where these stories are from, become aware of these markets, look at the rather crazy spectrum of genres that are being represented here and subgenres being represented. And it's just one of those reminders that, there's a lot more going on in the field than we tend to often acknowledge as common wisdom, and it should be I'm not saying it's by any means mandatory or a moral hurdle or anything like that, but it certainly for me was an eye opener. I, who consider myself fairly well versed on, even though I don't read nearly as much as Fred, but I think I have a pretty decent understanding of the field. I think most people who fall into the SF Signal circle get that, And seeing something like this is just sort of, yes, it's daunting, but it's also an eye-opener when you see the number of names that you may not be familiar with. And the markets, that's the other thing, the markets. Like, I saw the Sarah Gailey story from Mothership Zeta, and I was like, hey, I read Mothership Zeta. I was like, yes, here's an obscure market I'm familiar with, yay, and I do a little dance and feel ridiculously proud of myself, and then I have to go back and realize, yes, I have to expand beyond Lightspeed and Daily Science Fiction and stuff like that. There's also quite a few novel excerpts in here too, which was very nice. Just sort of as a, not even a state of the art, but just as kind of a reminder of what's going on in the field, I found it very, very useful. And I'll probably be going back to it over the course of the year repeatedly once I get through other anthologies. So that's my little realization about that. So we didn't really come into this episode with any set topics or anything, but there were a few things that I wanted to talk about culture consumed-wise, if it's okay with you boys. Something that's been sort of sticking on my mind, there was something that happened... a couple things that happened in the comic book world this past month. Two titles that came out that are getting a bit of a strange reaction, and that's not so much what's concerning me as much as what my reaction to them is. The first one is the first issue of the Infinity Entity, which is Jim Starlin returning to the cosmic playground that he did with the Infinity Stones and Thanos Quest and stuff like that. And in this particular story, Adam Warlock, who we have not seen in a while, and we certainly haven't seen him since the end of Secret Wars, sort of finds himself flung back in time to meet the original Avengers. And it is... But it's kind of weird because I have a deep, deep-seated affinity for a lot of his stories. And I found myself reading this and kind of going, yeah, this does feel out of place, not just against a lot of the contemporary stuff that Marvel's putting out right now, but it also feels out of place tone-wise with a lot of other things that we've seen come from Jim Starlin. And I think part of the issue that I had with it was that it was sort of, it didn't really seem to try to be reclaiming Adam Warlock as a character, and nor was it really a rehash slash tribute. And in that regard, it just felt kind of awkward. The actual art on the inside of the book is done by Alan Davis. Starlin wrote this.
Okay.
And I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of Alan Davis. Mm-hmm. But he's clearly trying to capture a lot of Starlin's style, which is fine.
This is a limited run, so maybe they're sending out a probe, as it were, before they commit fully to bringing back the character?
Well, I think that's a distinct possibility, but given how many iterations the character has gone through, especially when Dan Abnett, I mean, Adam Warlock was a major part of Guardians of the Galaxy, and they got brought back. And, in fact, his revisiting a big chunk of his history was kind of the return for, much of what was kind of the catalyst for a lot of what happened to that before it became a Marvel franchise. But there's a lot of clever stuff when it comes to the original Avengers, the whole idea of Warlock fighting the original Avengers and just dealing with the battle and things along those lines. But it does tie into the modern, he's definitely setting this in current, continuity. So I will be, interesting to see where it goes. Plus, he also appears to be bringing in a lot of other cosmic characters that, he was, known to play with. Most of his series, you always have the Stranger or the In-Betweener or Lord Chaos. And so I'm kind of curious where that's going to go. The other thing I want to mention along the same lines is that Neil Adams is currently doing a, book for DC called Superman, The Coming of the Supermen, which involves some characters from the Bottle City of Kandor coming out and helping Superman in a battle against various forces. And once again, we're seeing somebody who used to be a mainstay in the comic universe making a return and trying to tackle a character that has gone through a lot of changes since the last time they covered it. And once again, there's a feeling of displacement when you're reading this book. There was a review that came up saying, hey, look at these wonderful little retro style stories, and they were really treating it like, hey, this is cute. Look at this old man trying to recapture his what comics used to be like in the 70s. And I kind of winced when I read stuff like that, but at the same time, I could also sort of see why the criticism was being made. And even though it's endearing to a lot of people, and even though I think the script is fairly good, it's kind of odd. I mean, there's certain authors and artists like who have been pretty solid and present. You know, Walt Simonson has been doing work on and off all the way through, so I'm used to seeing his work pop up. Chaykin's another one. But then seeing something like this and going, ooh, I had forgotten, you know, how this type of line work looks like in a comic, because I'm so used to seeing Photoshopped comics so often. So it's kind of weird, because I don't think either book is actually a fairly good representation of what these guys did at their best. So I'm gonna see how it plays out, but it was definitely a bit of an eyeball kick and a wake up call when it came to the state of comics and the fact that these are both happening. You know, DC is apparently ramping up for yet another reboot. Marvel just came off Secret Wars and still appears to be getting its footing. it's one of those things that I'm uncertain about, and I'm not crazy about feeling any form of ambiguity when it comes to reading my comics because I've been doing it for so long, and I'm not certain exactly where this is going to fall into things. We'll see. DC is still a mess. Marvel is still getting its footing. There's a new Iron Man Power Fist book out, which is really trying to be a buddy comedy, and I think it's taking it a little too far, but it's still a fairly good script and a fairly good story. But I think it nails the tone of Luke Cage really well. I'm not crazy about how Danny Rand is being portrayed in it, especially since Iron Fist is getting a lot of publicity for the fact that there's going to be a series coming up. But we'll see. Yeah, the comic field has been highly unusual lately, and having everything in this much flux is kind of, you're not certain what you're going to get. But there's still a lot of good stuff. Two other things I did want to mention. Monstrous, number 4 by Marjorie Liu and Sana Takeda. Issue 4 came out. The most gorgeous issue of the book so far. They could publish this book completely without word balloons, and I would just stare at it for hours. But Marjorie is doing a really good script on it, and it's definitely improved since the first issue. Matt Hawkins and Raphael Anenko are doing Symmetry. The first storyline of that just wrapped up. It's by Top Cow. It's a weird little dystopian story that has some AIs running around in it. I'm not real crazy about the storyline, but I think it's done a really good job of the characters, and the art is just spectacular. I'm really happy about that. And the only other thing I wanted to mention was the first arc of Gail Simone's Clean Room wrapped up, which means that will be out in trade very shortly. It is her horror series, which started off being a bit of a conspiracy theory series and jumped into the ugly stuff very quickly, and I really like this first storyline. It's nice to see Gail playing with her own characters as opposed to taking up another one, so I'm really curious as to where this is going to go. And the last thing I wanted to mention was that I am knee-deep into The Year's Best Weird Fiction Volume 2, edited by Kathy Koja and Michael Kelly, and a good chunk of this I had not read last year. I really didn't keep up on Black Static, and I read a couple of the fantasy anthologies came out where a lot of these are pulled from, but the Isabel Yap story, the Sarah Pinsker story, the Nick Mamatis story I really like, and there's a Caitlin Kiernan story, which I had not read, which surprised me because I thought I pretty much have done a good job of keeping up with all her stuff. But that was not the case. Didn't get as much reading done this past month as I wanted to, but what I got definitely delivered. So that made me happy. So that's about all I had for culture consumed. How about you, Fred?
Since last month, my short story count has jumped up a lot. My long story count hasn't jumped up as much. Also because much of the month I was reading or rereading Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson, which is a big freaking long book. So that took a long time. I also diverted myself once with another reread, Doorways in the Sand by Roger Zelazny, and the reason I started reading that again is that I am working my way through the massive, I think it's 6-volume plus an appendix volume set from Nesva of his collected short stories, and I'm in the middle of volume 1, which is called Threshold. And there was a story in it which reminded me of Doorways in the Sand, a story called A Museum Piece, in which a disgruntled sculptor decides to become a piece of sculpture himself at an art gallery. and is eventually joined by a woman who's also decided to drop out of society, become a piece of sculpture. And the end of the story put me in mind of Doorways in the Sand, which does involve some alien sculpture and alien artifacts. And that's just like one of my favorite books by Zelazny.
Mm-hmm.
It's short. It's a mere slip of a book compared to today's Doorstoppers. But, I mean, first off, Zelazny, you just like read this anthology. And the first story, I believe, is not the one that everyone thinks of, but, oh no, the first story he wrote, they say, I believe, was A Rose for Ecclesiastes. Mm-hmm. And you just read that story. It's just like, this is the guy's first story? What the hell, where did he come from to get this talent? So, you know, he's a wonderful writer. So Doorways in the Sand is wonderful because of the writing, but it's packed with so many ideas. And, I mean, you've got undercover alien cops. You've got this whole concept that's almost out of, like, Thor Heyerdahl with, cultural exchanges between islands across space. You know, you send the Mona Lisa out and you get something in return, and the Mona Lisa spreads out across the galaxy and,
mm-hmm.
you know, so on and so forth. Plus, a lot of people smoking and drinking, which, you know, always feels odd these days for me. Especially the smoking, to see that mentioned in a book. A really fantastic book. And I read it in like 2 days, and it's like, hey, I finished another book this year and enjoyed it so much rather than slogging through something. Which is not to say that Cryptonomicon was slogging, because Cryptonomicon is a lot of fun. I mean, I think I first read that book, As Big As It Is, in like 2 days when I was at a conference and I was bored out of my skull at the conference. So I kept sneaking it behind my briefcase and managed to get through the whole thing in 2 days. So, you know, that's a lot of fun. And now I want to, like, you know, dig up histories of World War II naval actions and code breaking and whatever. And, you know, once again, that dog and that air biplane and Up, you know, being distracted by somebody young squirrel. So, you know, here I go again. Who knows? A lot of what I've been reading has been for the Hugos. So, for example, I am reading a book called Future Visions, which is, weirdly enough, original science fiction inspired by Microsoft. That's Jennifer Henshaw and Allison Lynn. I'm also, I think, John, you read all of this. I'm reading Niecy Shawl and Bill Campbell's Stories for Chip. And I'm like maybe 3/4 done with that. Also reading Jonathan Strawn's latest, Meeting Infinity. More conventionally, I'm reading two by Fritz Lieber still, Smoke Ghost and the first Fafhrd collection. I'm still reading that first Conan collection, which a friend of the show, John Capaccio, did the artwork for. And I'm reading, no, he didn't do the artwork for that. He did the artwork for Elric, the Stealer of Souls, which I am rereading. Somebody else did the artwork for the Conan collection. So I'm like, you know, all over the place, new stuff, old stuff, all of it pretty much good stuff. The Delaney collection, I think I like more of the nonfiction better than the fiction. Maybe two of the fictions really just like left me like totally cold. Most of them have been good to really great. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the two clunkers just really clunked for me. And after that, I was like, you know, I almost put the book down. I mean, they're, you know, just so it's clear for people, they're not stories. Like, it's not like a story set in his universes or a sequel to something he wrote or anything like that. It's more in the spirit of. And sometimes the people catch it and catch it real well. But every now and then I think they just, like, bought something because of the person's name or something. All right, what do you think, John? You read it, right? Or maybe not. Did we lose John?
Hello?
Hello?
Yep.
Okay.
God. Sorry. So I think that you're right that the nonfiction was stronger than the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because to do a tribute to someone in fiction like that without either, you know, making it a tribute or working in one of their story worlds, the connection can be harder to make for the reader.
Right.
Like the writer knows perfectly well what the connections are that they're trying to bring out, the homage that they're creating.
Unless you sit there and go, as you know, Jim, or as you know, Bill, or whatever.
As you know, Sandy.
Right.
Sure. But I think it's just easier to see in the nonfiction, because you're being told what they think, you know, what Chip's meant to them and how he's affected them and things like that. So, I think I agree that the fiction was not as strong as the nonfiction, but I wasn't sort of put off by anything that didn't, you know, resonate. I just sort of pushed on. It's an anthology and just, you know.
Yeah. No, they were just a couple with just,
mm-hmm.
I mean, they just didn't do anything for me as a story. So I'm like, okay, why is it here?
Right.
Oh, probably because it's so-and-so, and they want that name because somebody will buy this anthology because that person's name is here.
Oh, I see.
I was like, yeah, you know, I could have lived without it. I mean, like, I really was amused with the first story, you know, Michael Swanwick and Chip Delaney eat hamburgers at a rest stop in New Jersey. I mean, you know, like that, you know, literally really made me laugh out loud. There was one that put me in mind of the Star Pit, you know, by Delaney. Yeah, you know, so there's a lot of things like that ring for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. Still working through it. Enjoying it. Anything else? Still listening to way too many podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. X-Files. I want to talk about the X-Files. So, the X-Files came back.
Like a zombie from the grave.
Da 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 da.
So maybe it shouldn't have come back, or maybe it should have come back more. That's the problem. He had six episodes. The first and last episode were basically linked, and they were both by Chris Carter. Then you had four in the middle. Putting aside the first and last for the moment, the four in the middle, there was one that was great that involved the Lizard Man. Or a man that became a lizard that became a man, and I don't want to say much without spoiling it, but it was hilarious. I thought that was like the best thing they did. There was one clunker, and there were two okays that could have been great. But the first and last episode, Chris Carter basically took the mythology, you know, with a capital M, that, you know, the aliens were there, and there was a big government conspiracy and all that other stuff. Put a twist on it, but in doing so, in 2 hours, he did probably what should have been like a season's worth of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And then ended it to the point where literally all three of us, myself, my wife, my daughter, got to the end of the episode, and we're like, I said, what the fuck just happened? Because it ended. It didn't conclude. It just dropped off a cliff. And whether, I mean, they've already announced that they're going to bring it back. Whether they continue the story or not, I have my doubts, because it put me in mind with the one X-Files spinoff show called Millennium.
Yeah.
The first season of which was supposed to be leading up to the Millennium, where, you know, things were going to happen, you know, never mind the Y2K bug for computers, but there were like all sorts of theories that things were going to happen to destroy things. So the end of that first season ended with the main character, somehow this mysterious disease had broken out, society was collapsing, and he was in a cabin by himself, you know, barely alive. And then the second season opened up and everyone's like, oh yeah, you know, we recovered. And you're like, wait, whoa, 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 whoa. So I have a feeling this, the final episode of The X-Files for this limited run was basically, in the space of a one-hour show, society was collapsing with mysterious diseases and whatever. They've got a cure, they're trying to implement it, but the way this thing is playing out, it's like, well, how the hell did civilization collapse so fast? And if you've found a cure, how are you going to spread it if civilization has collapsed this fast, this far, you know, that far, that's this fast? It's like, you know, Chris, maybe you should retire and let the other guys do more. or spend more than two episodes of trying to spread the story, which no way you could. It was like reading Twitter. You know, you're trying to get a story by 140 characters at a time, and making a major change at the end of every 140 characters. You're like, what's going on here? So that was my X-Files adventure. I don't know if either of you watched it or not, but
no, yeah. I did not.
Okay. On the plus side, we're watching Twin Peaks again, hoping to get to the end of that before the new that reboot comes, and hoping that that reboot does not become The X-Files. So we'll see.
Alrighty.
And that's about my culture that I consumed.
That's funny. I like that.
Excellent.
So, John, what have you been reading?
What have I been reading? Not as much as Fred, that's for sure. So, but we always say that because it's always true. Anyway, yes, I have read some things. Things have been read. I read, in an odd moment of impulse, I actually went back and read Tunnel in the Sky.
Ooh.
By Robert Heinlein.
Yep.
And I have not read it probably in a quarter century, which makes me feel really old. But also was interesting because the last time I read it, I was getting ready to go into college. And I do this weird thing every time I have a life change. I decide that maybe I should read other stuff than science fiction.
Uh-oh.
So I try to put it away for a year or two. And maybe for a year or so, you know, I sort of stay away from it, and then I come gambling back. Yeah, it's strange. It happened when I was an undergrad. It happened when I was a grad student. Because I thought, well, grad students don't read that stuff. I was quickly disavowed of that notion by my peers. And, yeah. But anyway, so I hadn't picked that up in a long time. And I went back to it, and it was pretty darn good. There are definitely problematic things. Oh, the problematic things of Heinlein. But I enjoyed it. I read it pretty quickly, and it's nicely paced overall. You know, it's that clarity of language that Heinlein at his best employs. And he gives you characters that are a little stereotypical. And then he sort of tries to put a twist on them. And I like some, several of the characters in the book. I remember them very fondly from growing up, so. But the odd thing is, I never liked Rod Walker.
Huh.
I liked Carolyn and Jimmy and Jack. But I never really liked Rod Walker, and I never figured out why. And this time, it just occurred to me when I finished the book that he's so, it's gonna sound weird. He's so dead inside. You know, the way he reacts to stuff is sort of with a cold anger.
Right.
That he tries to never present to anyone. And he's just so repressed. Even when no one's there, he pretends to, you know, sort of be a tough guy. He never lets himself relax or really ever tries to not let anything get to him emotionally. And when I thought that, I immediately thought that's why I don't like the character. It's not that he's a bad person or he's quote unquote unlikable, but it was the whole sort of cold masculinity thing that was going on that maybe just not like the character. But despite that, I like the book, and I like how the character works in the book, even though it ends up coming down to, you know, the sort of the masculine, rational man will save the day, even though he does dumb things, which was nice to see. There was just that feeling of a pretty tried and true plot formula. But it's a lot of fun to read, and it was a nice step back, which is something I don't do very often, because I just feel like there were so many other books to read. But that was the first thing I read, and then I read Nancy Hightower's book of poetry, The Acolyte, of which there is a review at Grumptroll, and I wish people would go read it. So that was a very powerful reading experience for me, because what she starts talking about early in the poems matches some of my experiences religiously. So that really pulled me into it. And then she tells basically she sort of re-lenses biblical stories from the perspective of the people who are the focus of them. And I liked that. It wasn't as powerful to me personally, but it's very well done. She's a very precise poet, even though it doesn't immediately seem that she's got a lot of discipline of structure. What you sort of figure out is because she's going for something simultaneously more visceral and more philosophical, that the way that she uses language is seemingly simple in some places, but actually quite complicated. And she really goes out on the limb in the way that she uses words and creates associations and impressions. So I quite liked it. I actually read another review of it after I wrote the review, where someone went off on a wholly different tangent. And I thought that's great, because obviously this book really speaks differently to various people. And that's, I think, especially in poetry, which is something that you want. There's not just one thing going on. There should be a lot of stuff going on in a good poem. So that was good. I enjoyed that. And then I read the second volume of Rat Queens, which was, like the first volume, a lot of fun. It feels a little more serious. And there's a little bit of a feeling of not settling down, but the writer is really finding his place with the characters. So the characters, which were pretty well done in the first volume, continue to be well done. And it's just this great sort of mix of vulgarity and empowerment, which is a fascinating combination to see, because a lot of people don't take that route. You know, empowerment is supposed to be, you know, logical or, you know, compassionate, or, and this is got elements of that, but it's really just, you know, like, kind of like a lot of your D&D games back in high school.
Yeah. But
with much better characters.
Now, we discussed the first volume with who, do you remember? There was a guest on. And I think it was mentioned that at that point, either the artist or the writer was leaving the strip.
The artist left. Right?
Okay, so is this volume with the new artist?
Yes.
And I mean, is it
the art is still great?
Okay, that's.
He was able to reproduce some of the energy that the first artist had, and his style has a little bit more cleanness to it, And it's really vibrant. So this artist was a very good replacement for the first one. So that was way cool. All right, then I read a large book of Chinese hermit poetry. Which was great. It's called...
John, I just want to say I'm glad to see you're living up to your Twitter handle.
Why, thank you. That's great. So I read the Collected Songs of Cold Mountain. Han Shan, who's a well-known Buddhist monk from back in the old days, and was an inspiration for Jack Kerouac, actually. But despite that, I wanted to read this book anyway. And it's really hard to communicate what the poetry does because it is so simple and so plain in its setup and delivery and the choice of language that at first you're a little worried. It's like, this doesn't seem like a very evocative poetry. But I think you have to go back and reread them a few times and turn them over in your head before they start to open themselves up. And that's something I love about poetry, is when you don't get it the first time, but you know there's something there. You just have to go back and find it. And that's what a lot of the Cold Mountain poems do. The translation seems really good. It's very straightforward. And there's a nice bit about the life of Han Shan and some other Chinese hermit monks in the same period. So it's nice. It's a really lovely thing to to sit down with and just fall into for a while. And that was a really powerful read, because the majority of poetry books that I read are often not very long. Like the Hightower book is like 55 pages long or around there. And this is much larger. But it's just, like I said, it's very well done. It feels like the translators have gotten to the spirit of a lot of the poems. And you know, the funny thing is, there are a few times where I read the poem and had that reaction of, I have to go back and see what's there. And once in a while, there's nothing there. But overall, it's really lovely collection. I'll be going back and reading it from time to time, definitely, because it was pretty cool. And that, I think, is all of mine.
What year was that, the Buddhist book?
The Collected Songs of Cold Mountain?
Yeah.
It was published in some dark distant time. Perhaps. I don't have it in the room with me, so.
Okay.
All right. Published June 2000.
Oh.
According to, Goodreads.
Neat.
Yeah, reading The Hightower just suddenly got me back into, wow, I want to read more poetry. So I've actually got a stack of like 5 or 6 poetry books by my bed now to dig into from time to time.
And there's even an ebook version.
Oh, how about that? There you go.
Yep.
Neat. Yeah, I have not been reading.
Oh, and I should also mention that it's dual language. So, for those who are capable, you can actually read the poems in the original language.
And this must be the same edition because it says it's bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
John Blofeld and Red Pine. Yep.
Cool. That's the one.
I don't know, John. He may have sold two copies tonight.
Excellent. Too bad I didn't actually sell them to you.
Well, you know, you're getting there.
I sold you on them.
He's always on the take. Look at him.
I'm trying, man.
Look at him. Look at him.
So, there you go. Cool. And actually, I wanted to bring up one more thing, since we usually bring up one more thing at the end if we wish to. I just wanted to point people to a hilariously terrifying article whose headline reads, Congressman proposes resolution to recognize magic as rare and valuable.
Yep.
Did you guys see that?
Heard about it, yep.
I saw the headline. I don't think I read it.
Oh, you have to read the resolution. It's supposedly about, you know, magic. Like, you know, hey, I did a magic trick. But a lot of the language just sounds really magic-y. You know, it's an art that transforms the ordinary into the extraordinary. It inspires positive change in the lives of Americans. You know, it's timeless in appeal and requires only the capacity to dream. These are actually in the resolution. And he's got six co-signers.
Wow.
So, yeah. I just wanted to point that out because I saw that, and of course I'm thinking, there's a story in there, definitely.
Yeah, it does.
Whether it's sort of a sad sack delusional story or something else, I mean, there's definitely a story in there. It's like, just incredible. I just wanted to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if you Google Congressman proposes resolution.
Yeah, I just found it while you were talking about it.
Yeah. You will find it quite easily.
I'm waiting to hear how other magicians chime in on this. If they mention the years and years of discipline that even the most basic sleight of hand trick normally requires, let alone the...
Mm-hmm, right. But here's the best one. I left out the best one. Whereas futurist Arthur C. Clarke claimed that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Why do you need that in a resolution? What does that possibly do?
He's trying to appeal to more than one audience for his future book. Who knows?
I Like Magic by Pete Sessions.
You know, it's you talk about the intersection of the fantastic and the legal. The story that I got a big kick out of was from earlier this week, which was the list of things that Paramount claimed were copyrighted in their lawsuit against the fan film that's coming out.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they said that it was supposedly damaging the brand, and they had said, let's bring a, you know, there had been a dismissal motion that was brought up saying they weren't specific about the copyrights that were being infringed upon. And so the producers actually pulled up this whole thing, uniformly gold shirt, the appearance of a Vulcan, the Klingon language, had this entire thing that sort of spells out the itemizes the copyrightable things that were part of it. And I'm like, oh, good Lord. So can we then talk about where a lot of these ideas came from and how they were developed on the fly and how the Klingon language was sort of fan-based anyway.
Yep.
And, it was just kind of chummy.
Ridiculous?
Yeah. I got a bit of a kick reading that and getting a, just realizing the depth to which, fan activity impacts the quote unquote legitimacy of, specific You know, I mean, it literally points out that Vulcans have pointy ears and distinctive eyebrows. Well, yeah, well, so did Namor during World War II, you know? So
right. Frankly, at this point, I'd rather see, from what I've heard, some of these fan films than what I've heard about the next series.
Well, the Anaxar, the Road to Anaxar fan film that came out, number one, the effects were just gorgeous. Number two, it actually showed spaceships in space, which was something the last two Star Trek films had a problem with showing. And number three, it was rather interesting in the fact that it took a documentary approach. Having all of these, characters say what happened during the actual battle and the lead up to it and the various challenges that things came in, which I thought was fairly interesting because I've always felt that the, there's been plenty of, quote unquote documentaries that have been done on science fiction concepts, and various, dinosaur things and life after people and the one that was based on the one that Dougal Dixon was kind of involved on, talking about the future of man after man, the future of evolution. There was one that was based on the Wayne Barlow book.
Yeah, the Alien Planet one.
Yep. Yeah, Expedition, and there was another one that was based on an alien planet that National Geographic was involved in. I've got them both on DVD, and it's nice. But I've always thought that there are certain. There are certain science fiction stories that I think would lend themselves to wonderful mock documentaries. Hell, you could go so far as to take something like Ringworld or Rendezvous with Rama and just say, hi, we're going to do a documentary about it, as opposed to try to actually adapt the stories that were based on within them. If you say, hi, we've got a bunch of CGI artists and that's all we've got, then okay, let's go ahead and whip something up. And when I see all this stuff about fan films, I think somebody tried doing something with Eon a while ago too.
Ooh.
Where they tried to do some things along those lines. But it's just fascinating that, someone can generate so much, lovely eye candy. And the fact that the fans have gotten as involved as they have with so many properties. I mean, Lord knows I did enough 8mm Star Trek fan films back in the 70s that I was involved in staying up all night sewing uniforms and managing to build a transporter set out of rolls of construction paper and stuff like that.
Oh, the good old days.
Yeah, when you could, and scratching the emulsion on the film to show a phaser and stuff like that, the fact that they can do more on a desktop now than back then is pretty fascinating, but I find it funny that we're seeing. You know that science fiction and fantasy have gone mainstream when they're the center of major lawsuits.
Yep. Puts me in mind, a couple of years ago, David Gerrold tried to kickstart his Star Wolf project, which has been floating around since probably the 80s. So who knows, maybe he can try it again and, the technology has finally gotten to the point where he can do it, as a fan thing and then move it to professional. That'd be nice.
Yeah, it would be.
Oh, my final thought, since John had a final thought, and Jeff, you put me in mind of this. Just learned of the passing the other day of Sylvia Anderson.
Yeah.
Who I was amazed to see in some of the pictures they showed of her of how many of the puppets she was the model for.
Yeah.
Mm. In addition to her work as a producer, or creative talent on like UFO and Space 1999. Mm-hmm. I never realized that she was the model for some of those characters as well.
Yeah.
So.
It was funny because I watched a couple episodes of the CGI Thunderbirds Argo, which they started showing in England last year, maybe the year before. But I watched four or five of them last year. And it was funny because as soon as she plays the older aunt that lives on the island with the Tracy family.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think it's the aunt. I don't think it's a grandmother. I think it's the aunt. And as soon as she started talking, I was like, that's Sylvia Anderson. That's and I showed him to my brother when I was down in South Carolina last year. And as soon as she started talking, my brother said, yep, Sylvia Anderson.
Did that series get released somewhere?
No.
Oh, okay. So British television is what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't think it got an American platform.
I think it may have made it to Canada, but of course that's a different region or different space TV or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. Here we go. Thunderbirds or Go Volume 1, 2015. Let's see what the format is. Thrilling. Nope. Region 2.
Yeah.
Damn it. There you go.
It was okay. It managed to, the one thing that it succeeded in doing that the CGI Captain Scarlet from several years ago did was that it really managed to nail pacing. They really got these stories really cranking and moving at a fairly fast pace. What I think they failed at was, I didn't even mind some of the changes they actually put into the way that the family functioned and the way that everything worked. But one of the things about Thunderbirds was the rather inventive ways that they got into their vehicles. That was something that was parodied by Wallace and Gromit.
Right.
Effectively. And I think they kind of missed the opportunity where, yeah, it's great. A couch will start to sink, but as soon as the couch starts to sink, this giant articulated arm reaches up, grabs you, and puts you into the ship. And I was like, well, that kind of takes some of the fun out of it, you know, if you don't get to slide around and bookcases aren't moving back and forth and walkways aren't extending. It was just it was nice, but if I read the production notes correctly, it was not all strictly CGI. There was some model building.
Yes, there were. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To get a bit of the analog sense to it. But yeah, no, I felt the same way when I read that. There was a couple of very nice tribute pieces out that came out that I was very, very happy to see as well. And, it's one of those things you go back to revisit some of the childhood stuff. And a lot of those shows do not have, you know, seeing the number of older shows, that are now on the digital, nostalgia networks and things like that. I've been watching Man into Space. Oh, and what was the other one that I just, the Japanese, there was a older manga that they started showing that I remembered seeing as a kid, and I watched an episode of it now, and I was like, oh no, I won't be rewatching this. That was mildly terrifying. It's like what I said about Neil Adams and Jim Starlin. It's a bit, there's a very disconcerting feeling when you dive into a story like that, when you go, wow, this is somebody who I haven't seen producing in the contemporary comics world. And they're playing in fairly established sandboxes that have gone through a lot of significant changes. And I don't even want to go so far as to call it retro, but there's a sense of, yikes, it's been a while, hasn't it? You know? And it's you know, I'm gonna wait and see where both of these series go because I'm huge fans of both creators. Mm-hmm. But it's a there's a major disconnect, you know, what after reading some of the stuff that's come in the wake of Secret Wars, especially where a lot of it is, wow, this is really good. And some of it is, there was no need for that. And then to have these things pop up, it's an odd way of making it work. That's all, you know, but I felt the same way about like the Guardians of the Galaxy cartoon and a lot of other things that I go, there was no need for this. There's a chance of it going somewhere, but there's really no need for it.
Right.
No, I hear you. I hear you when it comes to that. But people are dropping like flies, so we gotta take it where we can get it. Well, good.
Well,
it's the end of March.
It is
coming up on April.
I just wanted to say one more quick bit of trivia. So it turns out the Tunnel in the Sky is not in print.
It's in
Kindle form.
Yeah.
And apparently you can listen to it on MP3.
Yeah.
But there's no book copy.
Well, there is if you get the complete Virginia edition from the Robert A. Heinlein Society.
Which is not listed on Amazon, so I mean,
well, yeah.
Anywhere, so a lot of people might miss that.
Yep.
Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised.
I'm a little bit as well.
Speaking of surprise, I had read the Paul DeFilippo review of the latest R.A. Lafferty collection that's coming out in the Prestige editions there. And I'm like, oh, I want these. I want these so much, but I don't want to introduce more physical books into my life. Mm-hmm. It hurts.
It hurts.
Yeah. Well, that was the other, like I mentioned when I talked about the up and coming anthology, is it's like, you know, it's almost as if somebody said, well, for everybody who says they don't have enough time to read everything that's coming out, try this on for size. Thump, and lands it right in front of you.
Yep.
You're still catching up and there's more coming. It's Lucy and Ethel on the conveyor belt, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, rather better too much than too little, I guess.
That's right.
So,
I agree.
For everybody who said that genre fiction wasn't going to be around deep into the 21st century. Ha! All right. Awesome. We will be back in the month of April with more discussion and more things to chime in on. Until then, I hope everybody has a good remainder of the month of March, and we will see you soon.
Yep. Good night.
Good night.